So, we're back for part five of my interview with Joe Alessi. This is Bob Elkier, his lifelong friend and colleague. And this is not so much a technical interview as it is a biographical one. And so far, we've made it up to Joe's high school days. So let's pick it up where we left off. And I know I mentioned this earlier, but I want to tell Joe that I know what his endurance and range were like in high school. In fact, I'm repeating myself like a parrot here, but they were not like they are now. I remember, and I'm going to be brutal, Joe. I remember there was some air in your sound. I remember you praying for your chops at some stage band events, and I remember thinking to myself that Bill Gwynn, who was second trombone, moved around the horn a little better. He didn't have the, you know, the sense of the musical sense that you did, but I remember thinking to myself, how, you know, Joe needs to put some things together if he's really going to be as good as he needs to be. And of course, look how you turned out. I mean, it's astounding the way you sound. So my question is, were you ever in doubt, by the time you got into high school, were you ever in doubt of your potential?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us about that.
Well, especially there were a couple other events that you know, decided the direction of where I was going to go, and one was the Pepsi Cola thing, and then the other was two things happened at the same time. One is that there was I don't know if I should preface this by saying, there was a brass quintet that I joined around that time called the Bay Area Brass Quintet with very, very fine local musicians. And we were in the Young Audience program. Young Audience is young people's concerts. And that was an organization that paid our brass quintet to go into schools and do programs. So, I was not quite driving yet, but I remember these guys would come and pick me up from school, from high school, and take me to these gigs. So that's when I sort of started doing, you know, a gig. And that's right around the time I joined the union. I think I was about 15 or 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to go back a step further, too, if this is interesting. My first, as soon as I joined the union, there were two funny things that happened. And I don't know if one of them was a joke or whatever, but it could have been. But the first professional job that I actually did was a Hare Krishna parade. So now, there was a clarinet player in the high school band.
Steve Gordon?
And Steve Bergman. And he was at a dentist office years later after this. I did this thing. Was going through, you know, reading magazines, stupid magazines, as you're waiting, and there was some kind of Hare Krishna magazine. He just thumbed through it, and he called me and said, "You wouldn't believe this, but I'm at this dentist's office, and I'm seeing a picture of you, a photograph of you, and you're in a parade with the Hare Krishna, you know, people," so I said, "Really?" So anyway, that's one of my first professional jobs.
Yeah. Well,
the other job that I got called for right away was to play, and this is honest to God truth, to play tuba in a porno soundtrack.
Tuba.
And, yeah. Now I asked my father about that, and I said, you know, I played. I mean, of course, I could probably play the tuba because I knew all the valves, and I actually dabbled in tuba a little bit.
Wait a minute. You asked your father about the tuba and not the porno?
Well, he thought that, he said I don't think you should, this is not the right way to start off, you know? So he recommended I don't do the that particular job. But anyway, then, so I was talking to you about the
potential.
You know, there was a professional job that came open, and what I was going to tell you is that there I could see that I was getting drawn into this, in the professional world.
Mm-hmm.
In the Bay Area, so I decided to take summer school and get some credits out of the way and to graduate in 3 years. Now, this allowed me to do two things. One, it allowed me to audition for the Curtis Institute of Music. And then the other thing, there was a position that came open in the San Francisco Ballet Orchestra. So simultaneously, pretty much, I auditioned for these two things. And the ballet, I won the job. And the Curtis, my attempt to get into the Curtis Institute, failed. So it seemed natural for me to play the ballet job for a year. And I was pretty devastated not to get into Curtis. And but my mother encouraged me to try it again. And mm-hmm. I got in the second attempt. So what I know what your original question was, but it wasn't until, that's when you're talking about developing the high register, this is what you were referring to.
Mm-hmm.
What you have to realize in a brass player is that brass players don't, some kids automatically have a high register.
Yeah.
Okay, when they're young. They just know how to do it.
Right.
I've seen these kids come to Juilliard, the same kind of kids come to, they just can play the Creston in their sleep. And I was not one of those people.
I had to develop
my high register.
I remember that.
And it was through my own study and my own technique. Nobody really told me what to do. I had to figure it out all on my own and figure out how your face works. Everybody's face works differently. What I prescribe to one student does not work for another student.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also to meet certain musicians that had a big influence on me, certain teachers later in life, Glenn Dotson, who was first trombone in the Philadelphia Orchestra, and I sat next to him. Charlie Vernon also was a big influence. Charlie was the first guy to suggest play your Bordonis in all the different registers, not in just the one register, but play them in tenor clef, play them down an octave, play them up an octave, play them, and to really explore the registers of the instruments. I think what happened was, is playing in jazz band, not knowing really how to deal, I didn't have enough knowledge about the upper register, and then, for instance, playing a jazz band, 7:30 in the morning.
Yeah, and you were playing lead. You were playing lead.
Yeah, that's probably the worst thing for my playing.
Yeah, yeah.
To show up.
35 degrees out, your face is frozen, I remember that.
Yeah, I was always, I did believe that, hey, I should go warm up before I play in jazz band.
Yeah.
And I tried to do that, but then I would show up late for jazz band, as you know.
Yeah, well, we didn't set a good example. I mean, we were in the trumpet section, and we were showing up at 7:35 too. I mean, it was nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. So at any rate, I don't think I think what's interesting about brass playing is that just because you don't have something in when you're in high school, doesn't mean that's the way it's going to be forever.
Right.
And I've proved that with my own students. There was a gentleman, if you don't mind me talking about him. Mark Horner, who actually is not with us anymore, but he was a typical example of somebody who could not play bolero. He got into Juilliard and for the 3 years struggled to play bolero. And it wasn't until his last year, it was like riding a bike, this is how you do it. And one of the things I prescribed to him that I still prescribe to my students, that if you want to develop your high register, you have to do it through musicianship. You have to find a melody that you really like to play and play it in a register that you can comfortably play it in, and then write out and transpose it a half step up in each time and have about 12 versions of it. I say write it out because that's easier to do. Put in a bunch of different keys, but a half step at a time, and then you keep playing the melody exactly the same way that you did it from the half step below.
Mm-hmm.
Don't change a thing. And, little by little, through your love of the tune, you figure out how to do it.
Right. Rather than trying to accomplish it all in one fell swoop.
Exactly. I got to hit the high note, and then you do all these ridiculous
things. You tense up, and
things.
That's the end of that, yeah.
That's the end of that.
Right.
Exactly.
You painted a pretty clear picture of how you developed an interest in classical music, but did you ever think about a jazz career when you were playing in that stage band? Did you ever think to yourself, hey, man, maybe I'll go into jazz? Did you ever think about it? I'm not talking about as an adult. I'm talking about when you were in high school. You ever think about that?
Well, the only time that I really thought of that is, you know, there were two summers, two falls where I went down to the Monterey Jazz Festival. And they selected me. I don't know why they selected me, but I'm not even sure what the audition requirements were. But in that band, there was Ted Nash Jr. There were a lot of terrific guys. I can't recall their names right now, but Ted Nash Jr. was there. Eric Marienthal, Jack Irby. These are all guys that, if you look them up, they're really incredible musicians. And then Clark Terry worked with us. Chuck Mangione, Bill Evans worked with us. This was a really amazing experience. And then, in addition to that, you were the one who suggested listening to J.J. Johnson. And I absolutely fell in love with J.J. Johnson. You know, and I got the Eminent volumes 1 and 2,
yeah,
and wore those records out.
Yeah.
And then there was a guy named Johnny Coppola that my father said, why don't you take a few lessons with him? Improv lessons. And he was another guy who gave me more J.J. stuff.
Well, one of the puzzling things about this is you were telling me recently how you were working on learning how to improvise. I remember you improvising in high school. What, did you forget during the 20 years between then and now? Or?
Well, I think I'm still developing that. And you know what? I just did it last night. I played for a group of kids, and me and the pianist just, you know, did some blues and whatever. Believe me, I'm no Conrad Herwig or even anywhere near that. But I know how I would go about it now. Let's put it this way: I've never really fully studied it, and that someday I would like to fully entrench myself in the study of you know, blowing. And the way I would do it now is, and I'm convinced that this would work for me. I think everybody has to find their method how to do it. But what I would do now is I would transcribe solos. I was listening to somebody last night. I think it was a sax player, perhaps. No, it was a vibes player. And I said, God, this is a great solo. I would like to transcribe this solo, and if I had time. And I've used this tool called the Amazing Slowdowner. It's a little piece of software that you can get, and just it slows down the tune to a point where it doesn't change the pitch, but it just strictly slows the tempo down. So if you hear a lick, you know, it'll come out like this, like that, and you could make it even slower. And that's how I would transcribe. If I had the time right now, I would do that. And then I would play these things and recognize the patterns that happen. And I hear these patterns all the time on the radio, but I need to see them on paper, and I need to practice them.
Well, listeners, you know Joe as well as I do. One of these days he's going to retire from the New York Philharmonic, and he's going to go somewhere, and he's going to do nothing but what he just described to you. Because we know
right.
how well he applies himself. So in his later years, he's going to become the swinging Joe Alessi. So on that note, we're going to take another little break, and I want to remind our listeners that you can download this broadcast as a podcast at robertelkjer.com. It's robertelkjer.com, and we will be back for part 6, the final part of the Alessi interview, very soon.